Okay, the book of Obadiah is a very fascinating little book. If you found the book, remember we have some major prophets and we have some minor prophets. And by the way, why do we call them major prophets versus minor prophets? Important, less important? No. Long books and short books. And so we're in the minor prophets simply because they're shorter books. And here we have the book of Obadiah, the shortest of them all. So we have 21 verses to cover tonight. And so we'll see how we can do there in the book of Obadiah. As you're going to imagine, we're going to talk about the setting of the book and where this fits. But the problem is Obadiah has some information in it, yes. But information for us to nail down an exact date, sorry, we don't have it. And so a number of different dates have been suggested about where to fit this in to Israelite history. And it's really very difficult to determine. He's going to talk about in this book the way the Edomites treated the people of Israel. Well, the problem with that is they treated the people of Israel on a number of occasions poorly. So you're not sure which a problem case might be mentioned, and so the dating is very difficult. So it's hard to date. I'm going to throw out there for our consideration 845 BC. And if you want to differ with that, that's perfectly fine, because we're really not sure as to the date. But the message in this book is interesting because it really doesn't matter so much the date of writing, because the message is easy to determine, and it's a very powerful message indeed. If you want to divide this book up into two parts, if you want to take 21 verses and divide them sort of for an outline, if you will, I might suggest the first 16 verses, verses 1 through 16, talking about the destruction of Edom is going to be decreed. So the destruction of Edom decreed. Then verses 17 through the end of the book, we have the exaltation of Israel being explained. And this book is going to close out with what is a marvelous foreshadowing of the coming of the spiritual kingdom of God. So some wonderful things in this book. Now let's talk about the background of this book. For this, we need to go to the book of Genesis, if you will, and turn over there, if you will, to Genesis chapter 25. Genesis 25 will be the place where we're going to begin to look at some background for this book. And once you're there, I'm going to call our attention down here, picking it up about verse number 21. Okay, so Genesis 25, 21. And Isaac entreated Jehovah for his wife because she was barren, and Rebekah his wife conceived. And the children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it be so, wherefore do I live?" And she went to inquire of Jehovah. And Jehovah said unto her, "Two nations are in your womb." Now, ladies, you gave birth to one child. How would you like to give birth to two children? Twins, that's hard. How would you like to give birth to two nations? That'd be pretty hard, huh? Well, not literally in her womb. What's the point here? These twins, circle it in verse 23 in your Bible, if you will. Jehovah said to her, "Two nations are in your womb." What does that mean? Out of these two boys, two nations will eventually come. And two peoples, circle that, shall be separated from thy bowels. And one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger. Isn't it fabulous the way that God can look into the future and tell us what's going to occur? And one of the hardest things, and we'll just pause, this is a side point, okay? One of the hardest things for us to process in our thinking is, how can God see the future accurately as he does without taking away freedom of choice and letting people along the time scale make choices. And that's hard for us, you see. So some people think, well, if God knows the future, he must manipulate everything about the future, and therefore we're just like pawns. And hence, many people actually have a form of belief with fatalism, where they think whatever will be. It's God already knows it's going to happen no matter what I do. But the interesting thing is God is powerful enough to see the future, but still allow us to have freedom of choice. And one of the things that I like to use as an example of this, and I may have said this in the past, but how many of you remember growing up and you're going to school, maybe in intermediate or high school, something like that, and someone said about this troublemaker, they said, that boy is going to end up in prison. Now, when time goes on and that kid ends up in prison, do you go find the person that said that and blame them? No. What they saw was they saw the heart and where this is going, and they thought this kid's headed for trouble. Well, if you and I have an ability to kind of see a little inkling of something and see where it's going, what do you think God is able to do? Absolutely. He's able to know the future, and that illustration doesn't even capture God's ability, but at least maybe it'll help us process that God can see the future, yet still give us freedom of choice. So here are these two sons. What are their names?
Jacob and Esau,
the twin brothers. Notice verse number 25. And the first came forth red, all over like a hairy garment, and they called him Esau. And after that came forth his brother, and his hand had hold on Esau's heel, and his name was called Jacob, heel holder or supplanter, right? The meaning of that name. And Isaac was 80 years old when she bare them. So we have these two brothers. And God says, from these two young men, they're going to grow up, and from them are going to be two different nations of people, and the older is going to serve the younger. Now, as we look further into this, verse 27, and the boys grew, and Esau was a skilled hunter, a man of the field, and Jacob was a quiet man dwelling in tents. Okay? And by the way, just to make a point here, some in this audience enjoy hunting, okay? It doesn't mean you're going to turn out to be a bad person, right? So we just make that point. What's that?
Ask the moose.
Ask the moose. Very good. So, yes, he's a skilled hunter, and Jacob is dwelling in tents. Now, he goes out, and he's eating, and I want you... he's hunting, rather. Verse 28, and Isaac loved Esau, because he did eat of his venison, and Rebekah loved Jacob. Is there ever favoritism within a family by the parents? Well, we know that happens, doesn't it? And so this is father's son, and this is mother's boy, as it were. And, you know, it's not wrong to like venison, by the way. That's not the problem, is it? Let's just be clear there, okay? And Jacob boiled pottage, and Esau came in from the field, and he was faint. And Esau said to Jacob, feed me, I pray thee, with that some of the red pottage, for I am faint. Therefore was his name called, and here's where we want to underline in our Bibles in verse 30. His name was called Edom. Not because he's going to eat him, but he's... this red pottage, if you will. And so Esau is going to give rise to the name Edom, and we're going to see that a little bit later. And Jacob said, sell me first your birthright. And Esau said, behold, I am about to die, and what profit shall the birthright do to me? And Jacob said, swear to me first. And he sware unto him and sold his birthright unto Jacob. And Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage of lentils, and he did eat and drink and rose up and went his way. So Esau despised his birthright. we need to underline in verse 34 where it tells us his attitude toward his birthright. Because there may be a tendency for us to think, hey, the guy's hungry. There's a present need here. And he's thinking, the birthright's not doing me any good right now. I'm so hungry. What good would it do if I die? I need to eat something. As I remember my father saying, I need to keep body and soul together. But the Bible is telling us he despised his birthright. He's here treating. Do you think he was literally at the point of death? Well, if he just had this meal and drink and food and, you know, so forth, he survived, didn't he? Now, we need to go to the book of Hebrews chapter 12, and we want to see a New Testament commentary on this. Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12. Watch what it says here in verse number 16. We are cautioned, lest there be any fornicator or profane person as Esau, who for one mess of meat sold his own birthright. Now, in this verse, it cautions us, don't be a fornicator. Don't be a profane person like Esau. There's an example of a profane person. He sold his own birthright for a mess of meat. So the Bible is shedding light on the attitude of this young man when he was older, treating his birthright with disdain. And later, he was going to try to get it back, and how'd that work out? He didn't get it back, did he? Didn't get it back. Now, God had already said before the birth of these two, they're going to, from them come two nations. And if the progenitor or the beginning of this nation is a man who's a profane person, have you heard the expression, like father, like son? Is that oftentimes the case, that it kind of follows? If that is the natural course of events, a profane person who would sell his birthright for one meal, you know, and it was, I don't know if it was a very happy meal, but he got to eat of that meal, and that's it, now no birthright. So here's what I want us to think about. From this profane person comes a whole nation. Now, skip forward a number of years, and the people of the Edomites from that nation, we have an ornate map on the wall here in front of us. And one of the Murdoch children said, it looks like a potato, and then maybe I don't know at all. But I hope you understand that this is supposed to be the Mediterranean Sea. This is supposed to be the Sea of Galilee. This is supposed to be the Dead Sea. And this is supposedly the Jordan River, okay? And this is the Nile Delta, right? So this is North Africa. So if we go to the Dead Sea and Jerusalem is about right here, if we go south and a little bit east of the Dead Sea, by the way, the Dead Sea Scrolls were found right about here, but we go down here, come to Mount Seir. And in this region is where the descendants of Esau, Edom, he's called Edom, so now his family would be called the Edomites, they settle in that area. Now, what do you think happened in Exodus chapter 20 when God's people, and by the way, their territory spreads all the way down here to the Gulf of Aqaba, which is the eastern finger of the Red Sea, okay? When the children of Israel come out of Egypt, and they come in here into this region, and they want to cross into here, the Edomites are here. So let's go to Exodus chapter 20, and let's see what we find here in this place. Okay, I have the wrong, not Exodus 20. Let me find my passage here. What am I looking for here? Numbers 20, sorry. Numbers 20 is where we want to go here. Numbers chapter 20. Okay, and if you drop down a little bit within this chapter 20, you have the children of Israel. They're coming out of Egyptian bondage. They want to begin to come toward the promised land. So when I'm in Numbers chapter 20, verse 14, okay, let's read together. And Moses sent messengers from Kadesh unto the king of Edom. Thus saith thy brother Israel. Now, why is he saying your brother Israel has anything to say? Because the family connection, right? So he says, your brother here, Israel, you know all the travail that has befallen us and how our fathers went down into Egypt and we dwelt in Egypt a long time and the Egyptians dealt ill with us and our fathers. And when we cried to Jehovah, he heard our voice and sent an angel and brought us forth out of Egypt. And behold, we are at Kadesh, the city of the uttermost part of your border. Verse 17, please circle this or maybe underline it in your Bible. Let us pass, I pray thee, through thy land. Let us pass, please. We'd like to go through your land. You see why I did the map here? They'd like to go straight through Edom to get to where they want to go. And they even promised this, we will not pass through field or through vineyard, neither will we drink of the water of your wells. We will go along the king's highway. We will not turn aside to the right hand or to the left. And we will have passed through your border. We're not going to trample your fields, okay? We're going to respect what's there. The king's highway was a very prominent trade route. We're going to stay on the road, they would say, in essence, or the pathway. We're not going to, you know, disrupt your fields and your vineyards and so forth. Verse 18, now we're going to underline this. Verse 17, we underline, let us pass, please, through your country. Verse 18, and Edom said unto him, you shall not pass through me, lest I come out with a sword against you. So we're ready to turn to the book of Obadiah. That's just one example of what? How has Edom treated God's people? No. And so they had to go all the way around their territory with all their women, all their children, all their livestock, whatever. They wouldn't let them pass through. Peaceably, they made them go all the way around. So there is a long history of how the Edomites were despising, and there was this rivalry between the descendants of Jacob and the descendants of Esau, just as God had predicted would take place. Later in history, we see that during the time of David, he had to deal with the Edomites and try to take care of them. Later in time, when Nebuchadnezzar came against Jerusalem, remember he took Daniel and his three friends. When Nebuchadnezzar came against Judah, you know what the Edomites did? They were cheering them on. Yeah, go get those people. Tear them down. In fact, it appears from this book and other places that maybe they even helped in the looting. Now, this might be a later period of time, but go to the book of Psalms 137. If we date the book when I did, which I'm not sure about, but if it was that, they did this not let them pass and some other things they dealt with against them. Later, when Nebuchadnezzar comes against them, they were part of the looting party. So in Psalm 137, let's read verse number 7. Tom, do you want to read that?
Yeah, Psalms 137, verse 7. Remember, O Lord, the children of Edom in the day of Jerusalem, who said, raise it, even to the foundations thereof.
Okay. Now, why would somebody say, raise it? What does that word mean?
Destroy.
Raise is like when you burn something to the ground. Raise it, torch it, burn it to the ground. It even says right there, raise it even to its foundation. Just obliterate them. Who was saying this about who? Edom was saying this about Jerusalem. Yeah, Nebuchadnezzar, get them. Just wipe them out. Tear them to the ground. So Edom has this long history of being against God's people. So we're ready to go to this book and watch what we find in the book of Obadiah. Obadiah is a man of God, a prophet who's going to speak against Edom. And by the way, if you want to know how bad Edom was, if you study the messages of the prophetic books, and he has messages against these different kingdoms like Edom and the Philistines and so forth, only the Philistines are up there with Edom as far as how many times God has to preach against Edom. So they're really bad. They're on the chart all the time for these preachers to talk to them. Now, when you go down to this part, Mount Seir, in those mountains, and you have Mount Hor as one of the tall mountains in that area, if you went there today, how many of you saw, I think they've had it in some movies, Petra, we don't know if it's a tomb for sure, a treasury, whatever it was. It looks like a temple built into this, carved into the side of a cliff. You remember seeing pictures of Petra?
In Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Okay. I didn't know what movie. I thought it was in some movies. Okay. Did you hear that? So Indiana Jones and the
Last Crusade.
They're coming to this thing and the big rock. That's in Petra. They built not only temples or tombs like that, but the limestone is soft enough they would tear out, dig out, and they would live in caves, not just to hide, but they made like homes in those mountains. But now in the book of Obadiah, chapter 2, are you listening? Okay, good. There's no chapters, right? I'm just checking to see if you're awake tonight. Verse 3, listen to this. The pride of your heart hath deceived thee, O thou that dwelleth in the clefts of the rock, whose habitation is high. So they were up high in the rocks where they lived, and he says, you're elevated in where you live, but your heart is elevated. You have elevated your heart. Your pride has been elevated, and this is what they were saying. You can even put it in quotes in your Bible if you'd like to. The last part of verse 3, put it in quotes. Who shall bring me down to the ground? Because they were in a place in the rocks where it's hard to get at them. They had a fortified position that it was hard for their enemies to do anything about them. And they felt really, really secure enough to brag and say, who's going to take us down? Now read verse number 4. Though you mount on high as eagles, and though your nest be set among the stars, I will bring you down from there, saith Jehovah. I like to underline these because in verse 3 they say, who's going to bring us down? And God says in verse 4, I'm taking you down. When God's going to take down a nation, it doesn't matter who is watching. Do you remember that psalm, except Jehovah build the house, they labor in vain that build it? Except Jehovah keep the city, the watchman wakes in vain. In vain. And so God is going to bring them down. Verse number 5, if thieves come to you, if robbers by night, how art thou cut off? Would they had stealed only till they had enough? If grape gatherers came to thee, would they leave some gleaning grapes? How are the things of Esau searched? How are his hidden treasures sought out? All the men of thy confederacy have brought thee on the way, even to the border. The men that were at peace with thee have deceived thee and prevailed against thee. They eat the bread, lay a snare under thee, and understand no understanding in him. Verse 8, watch it. Shall I not in that day, saith Jehovah, destroy the wise men out of Edom and the understanding out of the mount of Esau? So God is describing these haughty people who think no one's going to touch us. We're invincible. We're set high in these cliffs. No one can touch us. And God says, I'm going to bring you down. Verse 10. For the violence done to your brother Jacob. Now, by the way, here in this verse, Jacob stands for just the one person? No. Jacob stands for his descendants, right? The children of Israel. So he says, how you've treated your fellows, shame shall cover you and you shall be cut off forever. In the day, verse 11, that thou stood on the other side, in the day that strangers carried away his substance and foreigners entered into his gates and cast lots upon Jerusalem, even thou wast as one of them. When God's people were being attacked, you're just right there watching and cheering them on. It's what he's saying in essence. Verse 13, enter not into the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. Yea, look not thou on the affliction in the day of their calamity, neither lay ye hands on their substance in the day of their calamity. Don't put your hands on getting stuff when someone's having this kind of trouble. How many of you have ever seen on the news where maybe there's a power outage, a weather disaster, something? Storms have ravaged a city and there's looting going on. Have you ever seen that in the news? God says that kind of behavior is despicable. You don't, when people are under distress, things are happening, you don't go loot them. And you don't root for the looters either. And so in verse 14, and stand thou not in the crossway to cut off those that escape and deliver not up those of his that remain in the day of distress. So can you imagine if Nebuchadnezzar, for example, comes in with his armies and he's going to take the people of Jerusalem and some people are fleeing? What if it Edomites, as it were, kick them back in there? Here's the one that's trying to escape. Right? Catch them here. This hits these escapees. What's the connection here? Well, if they go back on their family tree, what does it look like? Jacob and Esau, twin brothers. And that's how they were treating their own family members. Let's look at some Proverbs very briefly. At least one here in Proverbs, chapter 17. Listen to the words here of Proverbs 17, verse 5. Whoso mocketh the poor reproaches his maker, and he that is glad at calamity shall not go unpunished. Some people are happy when bad things happen to others. Look at Proverbs 24. This is a really fitting one. Proverbs 24:17, rejoice not when your enemy falleth, and let not your heart be glad when he is overthrown. The reason I ask you to put a star by verse 17 is there are lots of people who think the Old Testament was full of kill your neighbor, because the children of Israel went into the land and took it and killed the inhabitants. And so a lot of people have this idea of, well, the Old Testament was go in and kill and take what you can. No, what was the reason Israel went into the promised land? God said, it's not because you're so righteous. In fact, way before that period of time, God said, I'm going to have you in the land of bondage for 400 years. And after you will come after it. And I'm going to give you the land of promise. But at that period of time, way back then, he said, the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet full. What does that mean? They're wicked. The inhabitants of Canaan are wicked. But their cup is not full yet. It means God's saying, in essence, I can allow wickedness to get to a certain threshold or degree. But after that, by his justice, he can't let them go any longer. Hence the flood, right? And therefore, 400 years later, when the children of Israel came out of bondage, there was a timing issue. Why wait and make those people be in bondage for 400 something years? Why? Because he was giving an opportunity for the people of that area, those people of the in the land of Canaan, an opportunity to turn around. But when they became so wicked, God said, I want you to go in and destroy them. And it's not because you're so righteous. It's because they're so wicked. And so we see, flipping back to the book of Obadiah then, God is pronouncing punishment coming upon them because of the way that they treated others. Now, in Obadiah verse 15, watch this. For the day of Jehovah is near upon all the nations. As thou hast done, it shall be done unto thee. Now, I remember many years ago learning about some rules, and they were different metals. You've heard of these rules? The iron rule. And the iron rule is might makes right. Right? Might makes right. And then there's a silver rule. Do unto others as they've done unto you. And then there's what else? The golden rule. You do unto others as you want them to do unto you. And so we're not supposed to live by this rule, verse 15, as you have done, it will be done unto you. But God says that is a principle that often happens. Hold your hand there and turn to Luke chapter 6. Listen to what Jesus said in Luke chapter 6, verse 38. Give and it will be given to you, good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, shall they give into your bosom. For with what measure you meet, it shall be measured to you again. Now, this is old English. I don't know if you talk this way normally. I don't quite use these terms always. But with what measure you meet, M-E-T-E, what's that word meet? I can't eat that kind of meat. What's the M-E-T-E? Whatever way you dish out, whatever measuring device you use, that's how it's going to be measured to you again. So if I tell someone, if I get a scoop shovel and I shovel it on somebody, they're going to use at least a scoop shovel on me, right? So God says back here in the book of Obadiah, verse 15, as you have done, it will be done unto you. Now, Galatians chapter 6, verse 7 says, whatever you sow, that shall you also reap, right? So there's a principle here. And God says, I could be merciful to you. I've been merciful to you. He's allowed the Edomites to continue on for a number of generations. But he says, because you keep on acting this way, I am going to bring destruction upon you. Now, we're ready for verse 17 through the end of the book. And the prophets often get to do dual duty. And by that I mean this. Many of these prophets got to give a message that's right there for right then. That's most of their work. A message for their day. But many of them got to write down some stuff that God was using some imagery to predict and foretell a greater kingdom. Now, can you think of the greatest kingdom? I'm thinking if we're talking about a greatest kingdom of all, you have to admit a great kingdom would be one that would never end. Would that be really great? An eternal kingdom? And Jesus said, I will build my church and I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. So Jesus is talking about a spiritual kingdom. And even those people who never get to be in the church, he said, there's coming a time when you'll sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom. You see, for right now, you know what we often call the kingdom? The church, right? But later, when he takes the kingdom and delivers it up to the Father, the kingdom includes who? all of the redeemed. And that kingdom keeps on going. God's rule will never end. And so in verse 17, but in Mount Zion, there shall be those that escape, and it shall be holy, and the house of Jacob shall possess their possessions, and the house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau for stubble, and they shall burn among them and devour them. And there'll be not any that remain in the house of Esau, for Jehovah has spoken it. Is it true that using these two brothers, one right away being a profane person and one of them being a righteous person, if you extrapolate and use that as an example, ultimately God's kingdom is going to flourish and that's going to be righteous people. And how would we characterize the unrighteous? Well, using this picture, it would be Edomites and the children of Israel. And so verse 19, watch this. And they of the south shall possess the mount of Esau, and they the lowland of the Philistines, and they shall possess the field of Ephraim and the field of Samaria, and Benjamin shall possess Gilead, and the captives of the host of the children of Israel that are among the Canaanites shall possess even unto Zarephath, and captives of Jerusalem that are in Sepharad shall possess the cities of the south. And saviors shall come up on Mount Zion to judge the Mount of Esau, and the kingdom shall be Jehovah's. I believe what we have here is a depiction, ultimately a fulfillment in the spiritual kingdom God has in mind. And certainly there's some beautiful lessons for us here. So as we wrap up our lessons tonight, we only have a few minutes. I want to think about the overall picture of this book. How many verses? 21 verses. Really short book. What are some lessons that we've already learned? We've learned that God can clearly see the future, right? God clearly sees the future. And we shouldn't be surprised, or maybe I should say we shouldn't even be amazed, because it's God. If he can see these two in the womb of mother and say, ultimately, there's going to be two nations and they're going to be at odds with one another, God can see that. You remember back in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, God said what? There's going to be the seed of Genesis 3:15, the seed of woman is going to ultimately crush Satan's head. God was foreseeing this in the future. So what great lessons that we learn from this wonderful book. Okay? So we learn about God seeing the future. Also, when people are having a rough time, what does God think if someone takes advantage of someone that's in a hard position? He's going to deal with that kind of activity, isn't he? We see that with the Edomites. Okay? And then lastly, these kingdoms rise and fall, but God has a spiritual kingdom that is going to last forever. We saw that back in Daniel chapter 2, verse 44.